На Триумфальной площади Москвы полиция сегодня задержала 12 человек, в том числе...
В эти минуты в центре столицы вновь задерживают оппозиционеров на традиционном...
It's hard to deny that Russia is in the midst of a crackdown against dissent, or that the atmosphere has become increasingly repressive in the 6 months since Vladimir Putin returned to the Kremlin. It's visible in various forms and to various degrees of severity. From the Pussy Riot trial to the ongoing cases against anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny and left-front leader Sergei Udaltsov. From the 19 people still in custody in connection with the May 6th Bolotnaya Plosha protests on the eve of Putin's inauguration, to the early morning apartment searches of opposition figures like Ksenia Sobchak. From the expulsions of one-time regime loyalists like Gennady Gudkov and Lyudmila Narusova from parliament, to the shocking abduction and alleged torture of opposition figure Leonid Razvozhayev. Russia, of course, has a long history of crackdowns and repressions, with different purposes and different results. From the Tsarist Okhranka's campaign against revolutionaries, to the Stalinist terror of the 1930s, to the targeted repression of dissidents in the late Soviet period. This week, many in Russia, and much of the former USSR, marked the Day of Remembrance of Victims of Political Repression. Can the past teach us anything about Russia's latest crackdown? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. My regular co-host Kirill Coburn is still running around Siberia, but promises to be back next week. And this week, it takes two people to fill Kirill's big shoes. On the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and an author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark, for the second straight week.
Always good to be here.
Always good to have you. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, and author of another one of my online favorites, Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And it's great to finally have you both on at the same time. This is a dry run for when I have all four of us on at the same time at some point in the future. Sean, I want to start with you, since you're the historian in the house. Every time there's a crackdown in Russia, it's fashionable for 1937 to pop up, the 1937 analogies. And indeed, we've been hearing them for months now. Now, all the hyperbole aside, we're clearly not moving into Stalinism here, but we are moving into something. And a lot of things from the Brezhnev era have popped up. Psychiatric clinics and labor camps for dissidents, for example. They appear to be making a comeback. And the legislative machinery for a future repression seems to clearly be falling into place. Which crackdowns from the past do you think are most instructive about where we are now and where we may be going?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this the last 24 hours or so, and my immediate thought was to go and look at some of the literature on late Tsarist Russia and police repression and police tactics. And Jonathan Daly has actually written two very excellent books on the Tsarist police from the 1860s until 1917. And looking at that literature, one of the things I realized is that the late imperial period doesn't fit really at all. Well, it does in the sense that of the legislative stuff. I think there might be something to learn in terms of the legislative crackdown and expanding issues of political crime and things like this. But the big difference is that the Tsarist government, of course, was dealing with a real revolutionary opposition. Exactly. I mean, there were terrorist attacks, there was bombings, there were shootings, and these only escalated. I think that, of course, we can all simply agree that the Stalinist period doesn't work either, because the repressions there were not really against an opposition. I mean, Stalin was at the peak of his power in the late 30s. There's no discernible political opposition to his power. So, and plus the terror there is a completely different social dynamic. I think the 70s might actually work quite well, in the sense that the types of police actions and attempts to silence various opposition figures is a little bit more surgical in some way. There isn't this kind of mass sweep up, and it seems to, from looking at it, it's mostly targeting the left. which is an interesting thing to talk about. Like, why is the radical left being the main target of the Kremlin's effort, or the investigative committee's effort to stifle the opposition? But at the same time, this is a very new thing, right? Because the types of repression and police action also depends on the type of opposition forces you have, right? So in the SARS period, you're dealing with a very conspiratorial revolutionary movement, so that needs informants and things like this. The opposition now is incredibly transparent. I mean, there's no use for informants and things like this. And also, the question is, what does the opposition really want? They're not revolutionaries, right? They're not looking to change. And in some ways, they kind of do resemble the 70s, particularly in Eastern Europe, because really what they seem to be asking for is for the system to obey its own rules.
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
So it's a very interesting dynamic, and it always makes me wonder is why the Kremlin resorts to a heavy hand in this situation, because the things they're asking for are really quite modest.
And things that the Kremlin could probably deliver without too much threat to itself at this time.
I absolutely think so. I mean, if one lesson could be learned from, say, the late Tsarist period, is the crackdown could precipitate a radicalization.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the big mistakes, say, that the Tsar, Nicholas II, made is that he didn't, or even Alexander III, didn't incorporate the educated elite into the system to at least get them on side to denounce the type of activities that oppositionists or revolutionaries engaged in. So there was no real voicing of, you know, terror against terrorism in the late Tsarist period on the part of educated elite. So it always makes me wonder why they don't give a little to gain more in the future. And I think this goes to Marx has said this repeatedly, is that it's really hard to discern a real strategy here. It's kind of like they're jumping from one thing to another.
Yeah, Kirill has said that repeatedly as well. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd probably start by actually just slightly picking up on one point and questioning it. The idea that what opposition wants is quite modest and therefore could easily be incorporated, in the sense of actually it's very, very corrosive for a regime like Putin's to start making concessions full stop. But secondly, particularly the whole point that the law is something which state should be subjected, which is a fairly central point about the opposition, actually I think would be devastating. But anyway, To go on to the issue of repression, absolutely the Stalin model is inappropriate. But I think it's worth bringing up two points on that. First of all is that repression can be used for two purposes. It can be conservative or it can be transformative. Now, Stalin's use of coercion was often transformative, to eliminate an old elite and to bring in a new one and so forth. We're very much talking about the conservative model here. But on the other hand, one element of Stalinism that might be worth bringing up is the extent to which, although there was clearly a strategy, shall we say, and a drive from above, nonetheless, repression became a matter in which actually lots of individual actors and institutions used to... Maybe it was how you curried favor with the man at the top. Maybe it was instead actually how you wiped out your own personal and political rivals. But the point is that actually terror had its own momentum. And one of the interesting things for me, and this is one of the ways in which what we see now is different from the 1970s, is that precisely in the 1970s, there was a very clear sense of a single institutional actor that was dominating it, the KGB, and a very specific sense of what it was for. Now, we see, and it's not just, but obviously particularly with Bastrykin in the Investigations Committee, that sense that in fact coercion is being used within the broad framework of permission being granted from the Kremlin, but not as part of a sort of a careful strategy. And if I can just throw in one last kind of conceptual point before sort of stopping is, I mean, I always see societies as actually... all societies operate somewhere within a triangle, wherein the sort of the respective apexes are legitimacy, I obey the state because I think it's right. Co-optation, I obey the state because it's in my own personal interests. And coercion, I obey the state because I fear it. And no amount of coercion in and of itself will actually do the job and hold a society together. Again, the thing about the 1970s is that at least for a while, repression worked because actually there were still quite powerful engines of legitimation and co-optation, even if they were declining. My question is, where are the other points of the triangle in the current situation? Putin can kick down anyone's doors, but what about the rest?
Well, and it's a point you made very well last week, and that came up that I was thinking about this week and wanted to get to a blog I never got to about that very aspect of it. And what drew my attention to it was that Putin canceled his call-in show. There were rumors this week that Putin was ill. Dmitry Peskov had a very busy week pushing back on these rumors that Putin was supposedly ill. He supposedly hadn't appeared in public. He, in fact, has been appearing in public. But the impression was that he wasn't appearing in public as much as he had been. And this led me to the Putin brand has really been downgraded. And the Putin brand was a part of this whole thing that worked in Putin 1.0. It wasn't just the repression. It was the money, as you pointed out last week, and this kind of Putin action figure hero thingy that kind of played to Russia's sense of national pride. Going back to what you were saying and combining with what Sean was saying, Mark, what I seem to hear you say is like the macro motivation seems to resemble the Brezhnev period somewhat in that it's targeting the opposition, it's targeting specific members of the opposition to set examples. But at the micro level, I don't want to say there are Stalinist methods going on, although what happened to Razvozhayev is moving in that direction. But you see that there is kind of motivations at the micro level to settle scores because a lot is now allowed by the investigative committee am I hearing you correctly on that?
Yeah, I think both settling scores and also, I mean, it's clear that Bastrykin and others are using repression as a way of advancing their own institutional agendas. So I think this is the point. We actually now have grassroots repression, shall we say, within the elite, rather than a sort of a careful, worked-out strategy from the top.
Mm-hmm. Sean, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I actually think this is worth thinking. Two things worth thinking about. First is something that Mark notes, and that is kind of the horizontality of the use of the. And I would say in conjunction with that, we have to think about, well, what kind of repression is really going on, right? The arrests and trial in the Razvozhayev case is actually a small aspect of a broader thing. What is really happening, I mean, on a wider sense, is harassment, is, I think, a mass PR campaign to discredit a lot of the opposition, and also the expansion of the legal space for some kind of future curtailment of, say, or at least to kind of legally regulate the types of protest one can engage in. So you kind of – the protest law is about restricting certain types of protests. Right, it's about kind of defining the terms in some sense. So I think when we speak about repression, we should consider this. And I think that a lot of those mechanisms might also touch on some of the horizontality that Marx seems to be suggesting, right? The player of the media, what role do they play in kind of this PR campaign? The play of the investigative committee, the play of individual members of the Duma who are offering legislation, sometimes quite crazy. I just saw something this morning that a call for banning South Park because of their Pussy Riot. Or I just saw a deputy suggesting the Moscow prosecutor to ban The Last Temptation of Christ. I mean, it's getting to – these are absurd, but they kind of speak to a more diffused atmosphere where certain actors can use it and exploit it to whatever ends they see fit.
And Vladimir Pozner got himself in trouble this
exactly.
week for speaking out on the Razvozhayev case. Mm-hmm. One of the aspects of this, and Mark, you touched on it, is and it's the other prongs of the triangle that have to go along with, or the other ends of the triangle or whatever, they have to go along with the repression to make it work. The things that bind the society to the state, I guess you can call this, for lack of a better term, soft power, right? If you have the hard power of repression, you have to have the soft power of whatever. How does soft power today stack up into with other periods where repression has worked or not worked. We've talked about the Stalin period, the Tsarist period, and the 30s. Those seem to be the other three examples we're talking about. So I'd actually like to have you both weigh in on that aspect of it. Mark, you brought it up, so let's start with you. Because soft power, I think, this is one of the key things now where I think this regime is in trouble. One of the key reasons is that its soft power is depleted. Its brand is depleted. How does this stack up to other periods?
Coercion always works best when it's actually part of a coordinated strategy and when it acts in support of the other elements. Why, in its own gratuitously violent terms, Stalinism worked for as long as it did was precisely because the coercion was deployed to improve what we might think of as soft power elements. So, for example, it excluded every other voice from the public discussion. It fractured society. No one knew who was an informant and who wasn't, and therefore you weren't willing to actually express your views. So essentially, it contributed to that sense that there is no alternative legitimate regime and that, in fact, you are doing well out of the current situation because you don't know of any alternatives. The problem is nowadays is we're in a very, very different type of society in which actually people can band together in all kinds of ways. People have had to have a sense of the alternative options that are at their disposal. And there is a very sharp limit to what repression can do about that. So if we're looking at sort of past repressions, the problem is how does that work with society? Now, arguably, to go back to Sean's earlier point, in some ways the parallel is more with late 19th century Russia, because there was a time in which the regime was less concerned, frankly, with what you thought and more concerned with what you did. It was a much, much more limited range of options that they were actually seeking to constrain. But again, we've got to realize that all these forms of coercion, they don't last. They provide breathing spaces as all. And that's something that Stolypin understood, because he twinned violent repression after the 1905 revolution with a very, very grandiose plan to try and reshape the Russian countryside. What we see at the moment is repression without that plan B.
Mm. So what I'm hearing here, and that there's a lot here for discussion. I mean, what I'm hearing is, I mean, the Stalinist one worked partially because the terror was so comprehensive, but also because it was combined with very effective soft power. The late Tsarist period was less ambitious, and it sooner or later didn't work because the soft power was by the late 19th century was depleting rapidly, right? And the Brezhnev period worked again until the soft power depleted, and now we're in a period of a sort of targeted 1970s style repression with the soft power depleting. Sean, what does that tell you about? And we're going to get this more in the second section, but where this might be going?
Well, that's really hard to say. I mean, I think that there is something to the point that the Putin's soft power right now is actually quite weak. I mean, there was a poll that came out yesterday. I think the Levada Center had it, that the anatomy of protest too didn't really convince many people of the violent intentions on the part of the opposition. Most people think that they are engaging and want to engage in peaceful means of a political transformation. So in this sense, it didn't really work on that level. But there is a question of we shouldn't, I think, overstate the power of the opposition to create itself at this point into a viable opposition or a viable alternative. I think that burden lies upon them as much as the regime's effort to kind of, construct them as unviable. And I think that part of the PR effort is to essentially, prevent anyone or prevent society from thinking that they're an actual alternative. In terms of where it's all going, I think one of the persistent themes that I think you guys, both you and Mark, have talked about, I think more so, is what is happening within the elite, right? How is the elite fractured? And how, at what point where one kind of more the liberalizing side will see an opening to take the initiative and move forward against the more conservative? I think that the real struggle there in terms of the direction Russia is going lies there and less in society.
Mm. And do we see, now going back to the past, do we see periods in the past where you did see this kind of fracture and it tended to move society?
I think the late 19th century is a perfect example. I mean, one of the things that historians talk about is kind of a dual polarization where the Tsar himself lost legitimacy amongst his own elite. More and more people within the nobility, more and more people even around the Tsar himself were seeing that the autocracy could not continue the way it was. I mean, I think even people like Sergei Vita is a good example of this, that saw something had to happen for the regime to save itself. And the reluctance on the part of the leadership, the top leadership, to do things to save itself led to, of course, coupled with World War I, led to an implosion of the system, right? I think it's worth looking at the fact that after February 1917, the provisional government is mostly comprised of people who are in the Duma. So I think that the fracture in the elite is actually quite key here.
And in the 1970s, it's less stark, as you saw, than the late Tsarist period. But there were fractures in the elite. And as Kirill and I have talked about on the podcast quite a bit, one of the more progressive elements in the elite was the KGB, ironically, because they knew the real picture. They knew the real dire straits that the system was in. So there were, in the successions from Brezhnev to Andropov to Chernenko to Gorbachev, as smooth as they looked, were very hard fought, actually. So you had fractures in the elites there. Now we're pointing to two periods, which actually ultimately resulted in regime change, right? The late Soviet period and the late Tsarist period. And again, the common elements that you had there was a lack of soft power from the part of the Kremlin and fractures in the elites, things that we see today. Mark, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, let's talk briefly about that Andropov parallel for a moment. When you talk about fractures in the elites and the fact that obviously late 1970s Soviet Union had those, you've got to realize that Yuri Andropov, a man for whom I still have a deeply unfashionable respect for, was able to bring together a coalition of people who realized that some kind of change was necessary. And it was a very, very broad-based coalition. It ranged from, in Soviet Communist Party terms, liberals, all the way through to hardliners, whose idea of reform actually just meant sort of squeezing the screw and turning the screws and getting the workers to work harder and so forth. But nonetheless, they were at least all agreed on one basic notion. The status quo is not sustainable. And that is the sort of broad thing that essentially held together the Andropov coalition. And it's the Andropov coalition which, after all, eventually was to lead to Gorbachev's rise, even though then as soon as he started to try and operationalize it, he then had trouble because how can you hold that disparate coalition together? The thing is, at the moment, in many ways, Putin won. Saw some of these pressures being played out.
You just anticipated, yeah.
Together, and it's already failed. I mean, it was fascinating. What about a week ago, Gleb Pavlovsky had a lengthy interview in Novaya Gazeta, in which he made a lot of really useful points, including sort of drawing the parallel, essentially, sort of Stalin renewed the elite, whereas Putin is just frightening them. But very much to me, that brought together the fact that. Actually, at the moment, we have an elite that is deeply fractured, even if many of those fractures are still not particularly visible. And I don't think it's going to fall apart tomorrow. But nonetheless, I think, to put it another way, the creative capacities seem to have been used up. That's the point, is actually when you have repression but no creative capacities. That is exactly when you're coming back to this point about when soft power, therefore, is exhausted. Repression cannot do the job.
And it's interesting, as you said, the coalition that Andropov put together and that ultimately led to Gorbachev bears a striking resemblance to the coalition that elected Putin back in 2000. And that people who were wrong, like myself, when through the Medvedev presidency, thought this was going to lead anybody that was reading the blog. I see Sean shaking his head. Anybody that was reading my blog at the time knows I thought this was leading to a Gorbachev moment. I was wrong. Although there was a debate within the elite. We do know that. And the side that wanted that Gorbachev moment definitely lost because I believe it's because of the fear of they know what the first Gorbachev moment ultimately led to. But now we're seeing that this coalition is not sustainable. it's just not sustainable. And so again, and this is going to bring us into things we're going to talk about in the latter half of the podcast in terms of where this might be going. Sean, is there anything you want to add before we move on to that second half?
No, I think we'll wait for the second half because I think Mark's point about renewing the elite is actually quite essential here for kind of figuring out where all this is going.
So that's a perfect note to shift on because this conversation seems to be shifting very quickly from the past to the future. So in a few moments, we will shift gears and make that shift from the past to the future and do what people like us love to do in our spare time, speculate. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from New York is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Разные точки зрения по поводу настоящего и будущего России.
Россия будет свободной!
Что я могу сказать?
Путина прогони! Россия будет свободной!
А будущее России будет мирным, успешным...
Nobody, of course, can predict the future. But everybody tries, including me. And not surprisingly, I'm often wrong. Back in the fall of 2011, when it was first announced that Vladimir Putin was headed back to the Kremlin, I speculated about four potential scenarios for Putin 2.0. Top-down reform, which at the time I called the Stolypin scenario, authoritarian modernization, which I called the Andropov scenario, stagnation and decay, which I called, of course, the Brezhnev scenario, and crisis and revolt, which I called the colored revolution scenario. We're now half a year into Putin's term, or we will be this week on Wednesday on November 7th, and things may or may not be coming into clearer focus. Mark, let's start with you. Where do you see this headed, picking up on the first half of our discussion? And definitely feel free to go beyond my four scenarios.
Well, first of all, I should say congratulations for coming out with four scenarios. Almost invariably, scenario planning tends to come to three. Things will go well, things will go badly, things will muddle along. First of all, I think it's worth pointing out in terms of long-term trajectories, I'm actually very optimistic that Russia is heading towards substantive change in a much more Western, liberal, democratic way. So for me, the key questions about the scenarios is which route will it take and how quickly will it get there? So, I think I'll throw out three, again, alternatives, which slightly parallel what you said, but all really rest on this whole notion of, well, what is the elite, Putin, but also all the others, going to do? I think, first of all, either we're going to have some kind of effort to just hold the line and maintain the status quo, which is sadly what seems to be sort of currently implied, which I think will be disastrous for Russia. Because, A, it will fail, but attempts to hold the line tend to, when they fail, fail catastrophically. And therefore, we're going to see an increasing polarization of pressures within the elite, more likely of sort of violent fracturing. But also, in the meantime, I think we are seeing that people are beginning to end game. And actually, if you look out at authority within the country as a whole, my sense is actually that Moscow's authority is receding slightly as people kind of almost sort of in political survivalist mode prepare the ground for what happens if the regime in Moscow collapses. So one is hold the line, which leads to trouble. The second approach would be an attempt at managed change, which has always been this sort of the classic model of the intelligent conservative reform that he may preserve. Again, I don't think that this will be as successful as I'd hoped, because managing change is one of the hardest things you can ever do. But nonetheless, it will lead to, I would say, a sort of a more partial modernization of the system, because I think that the people who will be advocating this approach realize that they need to get the new middle class on board, realize that they need to be integrated with the global economy, with everything that that involves. So again, I think that would be the sort of the classic Russian approach, that we would see a slow, halting, two steps forward, one step back shift. Of course, the third approach is actually that you have a collapse of the system from within. I mean, I don't think that there's any real prospect of an external sort of coloured revolution, shall we say, or, you know, suddenly the opposition movement sort of gathering a million people and storming the Kremlin. You know, when it comes down to it, probably, again, just as in the late Soviet times, one of the sort of the last bastions of the state to lose its operational capacities will be the forces of coercion. Instead, I think it will be that actually you would get some dramatic shifts from inside the elite. An attempt, for example, to oust Putin openly, or some other sort of major fractions, which would actually then make the thing fall apart. And again, for me, that's the wild card scenario. Because on the one hand, that could actually free up elements within the elite that are willing to operate in a democratic and consensual manner. But on the other hand, it also throws up the opportunity for then sort of much, much more repressive forces to get involved, or just simply a political fracturing. So I think that the point is that if the Russian regime doesn't actually adopt some clear strategy at some point, this system will fall apart. And that is in many ways the worst possible answer. So just to sort of recap, either there'll be a strategy to try and manage change, or there'll be a strategy to try and control change, or else there'll be no strategy at all and the thing will rip itself to pieces.
And this dovetails a bit with what we're saying, this other side of the elite, the technocratic side of the elite, the side of the elite that's not down with Bastrykinism right now, is basically waiting for their chance to implement this. They seem to think they have a strategy for managed change, or at least they talk like they do. Sean, what are your thoughts?
I think that what's confronting, there are a couple of things that's confronting, and kind of giving shape to all these scenarios, one or the other of these scenarios. And two things that strike me is a lot of the maneuvering, as Mark has repeatedly pointed out, is happening at the mid-level. I think it's interesting that one of the points that Mark constantly makes is that within the security forces, within the FSB, you have mid-level people who are kind of seeing the writing on the wall. And the second thing is, so there's a lot of activity going there. And the second thing is, how is the elite going to reproduce itself? You can't. It's really hard to see on the horizon once Putin either goes into retirement or is no longer to hold it together, or he's ousted. Who's going to come forward and kind of fill the vacuum? And I think that's the real dangerous scenario, because it could be filled by another, even more conservative elements, or there could be a period of kind of intense kind of, you know, civil war, not actual civil war, but civil war within the elite, if Russia's history is any indication, is always disastrous. But there's something to be said for the fact about the system's fragility. It kind of speaks to me in the sense that the fact that they're just towing the line, they're just trying to hold things together, there's no strategy, really suggests to me that there is a lot of a kind of weakness in holding the system together, because they can't go forward, kind of a launch forward to some kind of reforms, you know, bring in the middle class, these kinds of things, renew the elite. And they're kind of dancing around, or at least some mid-level people like Bastrykin are dancing around the idea of repression. And I think that this does lead to a very confusing situation amongst those who have something to lose if everything falls apart.
Do you share Mark's long-term optimism that the system is moving ultimately in a more liberal direction?
Well, liberal – I always have trouble with this word liberal, because – I think what liberal means in the West isn't really applicable to Russia's traditions anyways. There's a certain – there will be a liberalization
In a more pluralistic direction.
I think this is a better word. I think this is somewhat inevitable just by generation. I mean, once the people who grew up in the Soviet system kind of go to the side, and the people who directly experienced the trauma of 1990 wane – the generation that grew up mostly in the post-Soviet period, particularly in the decade of the 2000s, I think that generational change will lead to a more loosening up and a more kind of quote-unquote westernization.
Is this
so?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to shift to Mark, but I want you to finish your point.
Oh, so yeah, I'm actually quite optimistic about Russia's long-term prospects, just because the place has so much talent. And I think that given the way society is being structured, the way it's being integrated not only in the global economy but into a more globalized culture, I think the prospects are actually quite bright in the long term.
Is that the source of your optimism, Mark? Is that, this generation, this post-Soviet generation, I guess Putin's children, the people that grew up in the 2000s, that they're going to be more – for lack of a better term, European. And I can tell you, living in Prague now, when I meet Russians of this generation, they are largely indistinguishable from Europeans, where I wouldn't have said that 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it reflects several processes. One is exactly the rise of Putin's children, as you describe them. Secondly, I think it also reflects the nature of the modern world, that, you know, although it becomes very sort of voguish to talk about, you know, Twitter and Facebook and such like. But nonetheless, there is no way of getting around the fact that creates radically new communities, that your friends, your network, the news you hear and so forth is no longer necessarily geographically defined and therefore can no longer be geographically controlled, or at least nowhere near as easily. Russians, and I'm not even just talking about the, you know, relatively well-dressed and well-fed metropolitan middle class of Moscow and Peter. But nonetheless, you know, Russians as a whole are now far, far more exposed to external influences than they ever have before. Mm. Secondly, Russian business is now far, far more interested in what happens outside its own borders than it's ever had to before, and that brings its own constraints. So I think for all kinds of reasons, the sense that Russia can be held as some kind of bubble within which you can affirm orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationalism, and just hope that you can just ignore the rest of the world, that just is no longer sustainable. And given that I do feel that there is a strong central tenet that unites all Russians of pretty much anywhere on the political spectrum, which is that Russia is a great country. Not necessarily a great power, but a great country. And therefore it cannot just try and lock itself off from the world and ignore all the technological, social, and cultural forces that are taking place. I think that means that all of them accept, sometimes gleefully, sometimes reluctantly, that they have to be part of that world. Mm.
One thing I want to move to before we wrap this up is going back to your three scenarios, Mark. The one scenario of those three that doesn't seem to end in disaster is the managed change scenario, right? Because this hold the line stagnation scenario, which it seems like the regime's strategy, or at least those who are ascendant right now, it seems like their strategy, it mirrors my Brezhnev scenario, basically. It's the stagnation scenario. And as you said, this is ultimately going to lead, this is going to exasperate conflicts that already exist within the elite and within society. Your collapse scenario, of course, is very unpredictable. And when I wrote about this back in October 2011, I said that, you know, the color of the revolution, if it's a colored revolution, could turn out to be brown. Which is something nobody wants to see, or at least nobody that I associate with wants to see. And but the one scenario that seems to lead to a better place is this managed change scenario. Now, this can take on various forms. When I spelled it out, I had a more liberal, for lack of a better term, variant of it that I called the Stolypin model, and a more conservative, for lack of a better term, variant of it that I called the Andropov model of the authoritarian modernization. I guess I would say two questions. Do you see people in the elite that describe this new modern globalized connected Twitter-fied world that we live in now that really understand this and that can construct a strategy that can move Russia through this? And what would such a transition look like? What would such a managed transition look like?
Well, obviously, there's different sort of ways that one could try and manage it. But in many ways, I mean, what it would look like would in some ways be like Putin 1.0. The point is that precisely there was a certain creative force within that. The very fact that he didn't just simply decide to stay on as president, that he was willing, under very, very sort of careful controls, to allow Medvedev to become the president, which did exactly create the prospect that, in fact, if Medvedev had shown that he was a decent chap and he knew what he was doing, that Putin could have then just pulled further back away and allowed a new president to take forward, creating the notion that there can be renewal of elites, that there can be a different approach. And there can be, in Medvedev, a figure who's much, much keener on law than just simply authority and power. Now, ultimately, Putin held back from that. In that respect, he suffered a sort of not just an explosion of pride, but I think also of fear.
Mm-hmm.
He did have what it takes to really sort of, actually let his children go. So I think, it's not necessarily that alien a process that we could see that kind of attempt at managed change. So we could perhaps see something like that. But also, one can look at other countries in which they've tried to, for example, continue economic liberalization and allow grassroots liberalization. The thing about managed change is, yes, it doesn't necessarily lead to a catastrophic collapse of the old system. Catastrophic collapses of systems aren't always catastrophes, though. It doesn't have to mean hunger in the streets and mobs. The thing about managed change, though, is often it leads to a slightly stunted process. That actually it will mean that 10 years, 20 years down the line, probably many of the same sort of debates would be having to be held.
Perestroika comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly, which could have gone in different ways. I think, this becomes the point at which actually, scenario planning becomes very, very sort of problematic in terms of actually sort of going into the nuts and bolts. But if I had to think of what I felt was the most reasonable and credible scenario for managed reform, I think it wouldn't be a genuine pluralistic parliament, for example. It would still be that the deep state would continue, but that it would be a deep state that realizes that it needs to slowly, withdraw from such a broad control of society, but B, also slowly and carefully emerge from the shadows, or emerge from the depths, shall we say. And so you have a slow confluence of real power and apparent power, a closing of Sackler's gap between the dual state, shall we say.
So you manage the surfacing of the deep state as you manage the pluralization of the society simultaneously. I tend to agree with you. And again, I thought this was where it was going and I was dead wrong. But what you need for that to work is somebody to keep those security services in line. And this is what I thought in my most optimistic moments, the role Putin was going to move into. To manage the kind of de-Silivikization of the elite slowly, but without somebody as strong as Putin to pull that off, I would worry that he wouldn't be the worst of the bunch, that the other Siloviki might run wild. Sean, we got a couple of minutes before I have to be out of this studio, so I'm going to give the last word to you.
Okay. Yeah, I think actually the first Putin period is good to look at, because I think the symbolic, now we all kind of ridicule and kind of make fun of Medvedev, but I think it was a really important symbolic gesture. And I think that's why a lot of, including myself, thought, okay, now they finally get it. They can manage things, have these symbolic gestures, like have Medvedev in power and allow for some air of the elite to realize something else is possible. A means to kind of bubble to the surface and be incorporated is possible. It opens up space. And I really think that these – and again, this is what boggles my mind – is these symbolic gestures, in my view, aren't actually all that dangerous. They can be done and in fact are really within the elite's own interest to do them. So it just is a matter of whether this is going to happen remains to be seen. But maybe once things – it's hard to say, actually – where things are going, because we're in such a kind of confusing period.
Yeah, I think my last word on it would be, I think they had their chance for a managed transition and they got cold feet. They were haunted by the ghosts of what happened the last time they tried this with Perestroika, and that's what. And I think they just got cold feet, and now they're reaping what they sowed in terms of the explosion that's happening in society. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining us from New York is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, guys. I hope to have you both back soon.
Thanks for having me.
Look forward to it.
I'd also like to thank our superb producer, Tanya Koncheva, and a special thanks to my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, for his sage advice in Russia and his amazing audio production skills. Anybody listening to this podcast, and indeed any serious Russia watcher, should follow Pavel's Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch. You can find it at Rus Police Watch. Join us again next week when Kirill will be back from Siberia, or at least promises to be. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. And now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.